calls may be a stratagem to help activate the male's ejaculatory reflex, an analysis with which many prostitutes would presumably agree. Perhaps there is something to this idea, but even so, male primates are not known for needing a great deal of assistance in activating their ejaculatory reflex. If anything, the human male ejaculatory reflex tends to be too easily activated, at least from the perspective of women not being paid to activate it as quickly as possible. Especially given all the other convergent evidence, it seems far more likely that in humans, female copulatory vocalization would serve to attract males to the ovulating, sexually receptive female, thus promoting sperm competition with all its attendant benefits, both reproductive and social. Yet despite all the loud carrying on by women the world over, the credo of the coy female persists, writes Natalie Angier. It is garlanded with qualifications and is admitted to be an imperfect portrayal of female mating strategies, but then that little matter of etiquette attended to, the credo is stated once again. Sin tetas, no hay paraíso. For better or worse, the human female's naughty bits don't swell up to 5 times their normal size and turn bright red to signal her sexual availability. But is there anatomical evidence suggesting that women evolved to be highly sexual? No question. It turns out that every bit as much as a man's body, the woman's body, and preconscious behavior is replete with indications of millennia of promiscuity and sperm competition. Considering its almost total lack of muscle tissue, the female breast wields amazing power. Curvaceous women have leveraged this power to manipulate even the most accomplished, disciplined men for as long as anyone's been around to notice. Empires have fallen, wills have been revised, millions of magazines and calendars sold, Super Bowl audiences scandalized, all in response to the mysterious force emanating from what are, after all, small bags of fat. One of the oldest human images known, the so-called Venus of Willendorf, created about 25,000 years ago, features a bosom of Dolly Parton-esque dimensions. 250 centuries later, the power of the exaggerated breast shows little sign of getting old. According to the American Society of Plastic Surgery, 347,254 breast augmentation procedures were performed in the United States in 2007, making it the nation's most commonly performed surgical procedure. What gives the female breast such transcendent influence over heterosexual male consciousness? First, let's dispense with any purely utilitarian interpretations. While the mammary glands contained in women's breasts exist for the feeding of infants, the fatty tissue that confers the magical curve of the human breast, the swell, sway, and jiggle, has nothing to do with milk production. Given the clear physiological costs of having pendulous breasts, back strain, loss of balance, difficulty running, if they aren't meant to advertise milk for babies, why did human females evolve and retain these cumbersome appendages? Theories range from the belief that breasts serve as signaling devices announcing fertility and fat deposits sufficient to withstand the rigors of pregnancy and breastfeeding, to genital echo theory. Females developed pendulous breasts around the time hominids began walking upright in order to provoke the excitation males formerly felt when gazing at the fatty deposits on the buttocks. Theorists supporting genital echo theory have noted that swellings like those of chimpanzees and bonobos would interfere with locomotion in a bipedal primate. So when our distant ancestors began walking upright, they reasoned that some of the females' fertility signaling moved from the rear office, as it were, to the front showroom. In a bit of historical ping-pong, the dictates of fashion have moved the swelling back and forth over the centuries with high heels, Victorian bustles, and other derriere enhancements. The visual similarity between these two bits of female anatomy has been facilitated by the recent popularity of low-cut jeans that teasingly reveal the nether cleavage. "The butt crack is the new cleavage," writes journalist Janelle Brown, "reclaimed to peek seductively from the pants of supermodels and commoners alike. It's naughty and slightly tawdry," she continues, but with the soft, round charm of a perfect pair of breasts. If your moon is waning, you can always don a butt bra from Bubbles Bodywear, which promises to create the effect that's been turning male heads since before men existed. Like the Victorian bustle, the butt bra mimics the full curves of the ovulating chimp or bonobo. Speaking of waning moons, it's worth noting that unless her breasts are artificially enhanced, as a woman's fertility fades with age, so do her breasts, further supporting the claim that they evolved to signal fertility. Human females aren't the only primates with fertility signals on their chests. The Gelida baboon is another vertically oriented primate with sexual swellings on the female's chests. As we'd expect, the Gelida swellings come and go with the female's sexual receptivity. As the human female is potentially always sexually receptive, her breasts are more or less always swollen from sexual maturity on. But not all female primates have genital swellings that visually announce their ovulatory status. Meredith Small reports that only 54 of the 78 species surveyed experience easily seen morphological changes during cycles, and that half of these showed only slight pinkness. Once again, our two closest primate cousins stand out from the pack in terms of their decidedly indiscreet sexuality, being the only apes with such extravagant, brightly colored sexual swellings. The female chimp's red light district comes and goes, reflecting the waxing and waning of her fertility, but as Small confirms, the bonobo's swellings never change much, so that bonobo females always give a signal of fertility, much as humans do. Although many theories claim the human female has hidden ovulation, it's not really hidden at all if you know how and where to look. Marty Hazelton and her colleagues found that men shown photographs of the same 30 women, some taken around ovulation and others not, were quite good at judging when the women were trying to look more attractive, which in turn corresponded to the women's menstrual status. These authors found that women tend to dress more fetchingly when they are more likely to be fertile. Moreover, writes Hazelton, the closer women were to ovulation when photographed in the fertile window, the more frequently their fertile photograph was chosen. Other researchers have found that men preferred women's bodily smells near ovulation, and that women tend to behave more provocatively in various ways when they're likely to be fertile. They wear more jewelry and perfume, go out more, are more likely to hook up for casual sexual encounters, and are less likely to use condoms with new lovers. Come again? Much as women's breasts have fascinated evolution-minded theorists, the female orgasm has confounded them. Like breasts, female orgasm is a major head-scratcher for mainstream narratives of human sexual evolution. It's not necessary for conception, so why should it exist at all? For a long time, scientists claimed that women were the only female animals to experience orgasm. But once female biologists and primatologists arrived on the scene, it became obvious that many female primates were having orgasms. The underlying motivation for claiming that female orgasm was unique to human beings probably lay in the role it played in the standard narrative. According to this view, orgasm evolved in the human female to facilitate and sustain the long-term pair bond at the heart of the nuclear family. Once you've swallowed that story, it becomes problematic to admit that the females of other primate species are orgasmic too. Your problem gets worse if the most orgasmic species happen to be the most promiscuous as well, which appears to be the case. As Alan Dixon writes, this monogamy maintenance explanation for female orgasm seems far-fetched. After all, he writes, females of other primate species, and particularly those with multi-male, multi-female promiscuous mating systems, such as macaques and chimpanzees, exhibit orgasmic responses in the absence of such bonding or the formation of stable family units. On the other hand, Dixon goes on to note, gibbons, which are primarily monogamous, do not exhibit obvious signs of female orgasm. Although Dixon classifies humans as mildly polygynous in his survey of primate sexuality, he seems to have doubts, as when he writes, one might argue that the female's orgasm is rewarding, increases her willingness to copulate with a variety of males rather than one partner, and thus promote sperm competition. Donald Simmons and others have argued that orgasm is most parsimoniously interpreted as a potential all female mammals possess. What helps realize this potential in some human societies, argues Simmons, are techniques of foreplay and intercourse that provide sufficiently intense and uninterrupted stimulation for females to orgasm. In other words, Simmons thinks women have more orgasms than mares simply because men are better lovers than stallions. Stomp your foot 3 times if you believe this. In support of his theory, Simmons cites studies like Kinsey's showing that fewer than half of women questioned, Americans in the 1950s, experienced orgasm at least 9 out of 10 times they had intercourse, whereas in other societies, he refers to Mangaia in the South Pacific, elaborate and extended sexual play result in nearly universal orgasm for women. Orgasm, Simmons concludes, never is considered to be a spontaneous and inevitable occurrence for females, as it always is for males. For Simmons, Stephen Jay Gould, Elizabeth Lloyd, and others, some women have orgasms sometimes because all men do every time. For them, the female orgasm is the equivalent of male nipples, a structural echo without function in one sex of a trait vital in the other. Given all the energy required to get there, it's surprising that the female reproductive tract is not a particularly welcoming place for sperm cells. Researchers Robin Baker and Mark Bellis found that approximately 35% of the sperm are ejected within half an hour of intercourse, and those that remain are anything but home free. The female's body perceives sperm as antigens, foreign bodies, that are promptly attacked by anti-sperm leukocytes, which outnumber sperm 100 to 1. Only 1 in 14 million ejaculated human sperm even reach the oviduct. In addition to the obstacles imposed by the female's body, even those lucky few sperm are going to run into competition from other males, at least if our model of human sexuality has any validity. But while presenting obstacles to most sperm, the woman's body can assist others. There is striking evidence that the female reproductive system is capable of making subtle judgments based upon the chemical signature of different men's sperm cells. These assessments may go well beyond general health to the subtleties of immunological compatibility. The genetic compatibility of different men with a given woman means that sperm quality is a relative characteristic. Thus, as Ann Pusey explains, females may benefit from sampling many males, and different females will not necessarily benefit from mating with the same high-quality male. This is a crucially important point. Not every high-quality male would be a good match for any specific woman, even on a purely biological level. Because of the complexities of how the two sets of parental DNA interact in fertilization, a man who appears to be of superior mate value, square jaw, symmetrical body, good job, firm handshake, platinum Amex card, may in fact be a poor genetic match for a particular woman. So a woman and ultimately her child may benefit by sampling many males and letting her body decide whose sperm fertilizes her. Her body, in other words, might be better informed than her conscious mind. So in terms of reproduction, the fitness of our prehistoric male ancestors was not decided in the external social world, where conventional theories tell us men competed for mates in struggles for status and material wealth. Rather, paternity was determined in the inner world of the female reproductive tract, where every woman is equipped with mechanisms for choosing among potential fathers at a cellular level. Remember this next time you read something like, "The predisposition for influence, substance, and prestige are all merely expressions of a male positioning himself to acquire women with whom to mate." Or, "Mate competition will involve contests over resources men's wives will need to raise children." This may well be the situation for most people today, but our bodies suggest our ancestors faced an entirely different scenario. Sperm competition is best understood not as a sprint to the egg, but a race over hurdles. Aside from the anti-sperm leukocytes mentioned previously, Anatomical and physiological obstacles are in the vagina, cervix, and on the surface of the ovum itself. The complexity of the human cervix suggests it evolved to filter the sperm of various males. Concerning macaques, highly promiscuous monkeys, and humans, Dixon writes, "In the genus Macaca, all species of which are considered to have multi-male, multi-female mating systems, the cervix is especially complex in structure." The evidence pertaining to human beings and macaque females, he continues, indicates that the cervix acts both as a filtering mechanism and as a temporary reservoir for spermatozoa during their migration into the uterus. As with the complex penis and external testicles in the male, the elaborate filtering design of the human cervix points toward promiscuity in our ancestors. The idea that female choice, conscious or not, can happen after or during intercourse, rather than as part of an elaborate pre-copulatory courtship ritual, turns the standard narrative inside out and upside down. If the female's reproductive system has evolved intricate mechanisms for filtering and rejecting the sperm cells of some men, while helping along those of a man who meets criteria of which she may be utterly unaware, Darwin's coy female starts looking like what she is, an anachronistic male fantasy. But Darwin may have suspected more than he let on concerning post-copulatory mechanisms of sexual selection. Any discussion of human sexual behavior or the evolutionary implications of our genital morphology would have been extremely controversial in 1871, to put it mildly. Just imagine, as Dixon does, what would have occurred if the Descent of Man had included a detailed exposition of the evolution of the penis and testes, or descriptions of the various copulatory postures and patterns employed by animals and human beings. No one can blame Darwin for opting not to include chapters on the evolution of the penis and vagina in his already explosive work, but a century and a half is a long time for discretion and cultural bias to keep smothering scientific fact. To Meredith Small, the story of the female's role in conception is a miniature of the overall narrative. She sees popular understanding of conception as an outdated allegory of human sexuality, featuring the male as aggressor, persuader, conqueror. Recent research on human fertilization suggests something of a role reversal. Small suggests the ovum reaches out and envelops reluctant sperm. Female biology, she concludes, even at the level of egg and sperm interaction, doesn't necessarily dictate a docile stance. In addition to enveloping eggs, a cervix that filters or favors sperm, and vaginal contractions that may expel the sperm of one man while boosting that of another, women's orgasms provoke changes in vaginal acidity. These changes appear to assist the sperm cells of the lucky guy who provoked the orgasm. The environment at the cervical opening tends to be highly acidic and thus hostile to sperm cells. The alkaline pH of semen protects the spermatozoa in this environment for a while, but the protection is short-lived. Most of the sperm cells are viable within the vagina for only a few hours, so these changes in acidity alter the vaginal environment in ways that can favor sperm that arrive with the female's orgasm. The benefits may run both ways. Recent research suggests women who do not use condoms are less likely to suffer from depression than either women who do use condoms or who are not sexually active. Psychologist Gordon Gallup's initial survey of 293 women, data congruent with those from another survey still to be published that included 700 women, found that women can develop a chemical dependency on the boost they get from the testosterone, estrogen, prostaglandins, and other hormones contained in semen. These chemicals enter the woman's bloodstream through the vaginal wall. If it's true that multiple mating was common in human evolution, the apparent mismatch between the relatively quick male orgasmic response and the so-called delayed female response makes sense. Note how the female response is delayed only if the male's is assumed to be right on time. The male's quick orgasm lessens the chances of being interrupted by predators or other males, survival of the quickest, while the female and her child would benefit by exercising some preconscious control over which spermatozoa would be most likely to fertilize her ovum. Prolactin and the other hormones released at orgasm appear to trigger very different responses in men and women. While a man is likely to require a prolonged refractory or recovery period immediately after an orgasm, and maybe a sandwich and a beer as well, thus getting him out of the way of other males, many women are willing and able to continue sexual activity well beyond a starter orgasm. It's worth repeating that primate species with orgasmic females tend to be promiscuous. Given the great variability of mating behavior, even just among the apes, this is highly significant. While monogamous gibbons have rarely been seen copulating, so infrequent and silent is their intercourse, female chimps and bonobos go wild regularly and shamelessly. Females often mate with every male they can find, copulating far more than is necessary for reproduction. Goodall reported seeing one female at Gombe who mated 50 times in a single day. Echoing the Kama Sutra, Sherfe isn't shy about the implications of this mismatch of orgasmic capacity between human males and females, writing, "The sexual hunger of the female and her capacity for copulation completely exceeds that of any male." And, "To all intents and purposes, the human female is sexually insatiable." That may or may not be, but it cannot be denied that the design of the human female's reproductive system is far from what the standard narrative predicts, and thus demands radical rethinking of the evolution of female sexuality. Part 5. Men are from Africa, women are from Africa.
The sooner we accept the basic differences between men and women, the sooner we can stop arguing about it and start having sex. Dr. Stephen T. Colbert, DFA.
Permeating the standard narrative of human sexual evolution is the depressing claim that men and women always have been and always will be locked in erotic conflict. The war between the sexes is said to be built into our evolved sexuality. Men want lots of no-strings lovers, while women want just a few partners with as many strings as possible. If a man agrees to be roped into a relationship, the narrative tells us, he'll be hell-bent on making sure his mate isn't risking his genetic investment by accepting deposits from other men, as it were. Extreme as it sounds, this is no overstatement. In his classic 1972 paper on parental investment, biologist Robert Trivers remarked, "One can, in effect, treat the sexes as if they were different species, the opposite sex being a resource relevant to producing maximum surviving offspring." In other words, men and women have such conflicting agendas when it comes to reproduction that we are essentially predators of one another's interests. In The Moral Animal, Robert Wright laments, "A basic underlying dynamic between men and women is mutual exploitation. They seem at times designed to make each other miserable." Don't believe it. We aren't designed to make each other miserable. This view holds evolution responsible for the mismatch between our evolved predispositions and the post-agricultural socioeconomic world we find ourselves in. The assertion that human beings are naturally monogamous is not just a lie. It's a lie most Western societies insist we keep telling each other. There's no denying that men and women are different, but we are hardly different species, or from different planets, or designed to torment one another. In fact, the interlocking nature of our differences testifies to our profound mutuality. Let's look at some of the ways in which male and female erotic interests, perspectives, and capacities converge, intersect, and overlap, showing how each of us is a fragment of a greater unity. Chapter 20. On Mona Lisa's Mind.
Do I contradict myself? Very well, then. I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes. Walt Whitman, Song of Myself.
Faced with the mysteries of woman, Sigmund Freud, who seemed to have an answer for everything else, came up empty. "Despite my 30 years of research into the feminine soul," he wrote. I have not yet been able to answer the great question that has never been answered. What does a woman want? It's no accident that what the BBC called the most famous image in the history of art is a study of the inscrutable feminine created by a homosexual male artist. For centuries, men have been wondering what Leonardo da Vinci's Mona Lisa was thinking. Is she smiling? Is she angry? Disappointed? Unwell? Nauseated? Sad? Shy? Turned on? None of the above? Probably closer to all of the above. Does she contradict herself? Very well, then. The Mona Lisa is large. Like all women, but more, like all that is feminine, she reflects every phase of the moon. She contains multitudes. Our journey into a deeper understanding of the feminine soul begins in a muddy field in the English countryside. In the early 1990s, neuroscientist Keith Kendrick and his colleagues exchanged that season's newborn sheep and goats. The baby sheep were raised by adult goats and vice versa. Upon reaching sexual maturity a few years later, the animals were reunited with their own species and their mating behavior was observed. The females adopted a love-the-one-you're-with approach, showing themselves willing to mate with males of either species. But the males, even after being back with their own species for 3 years, would mate only with the species with which they were raised. Research like this suggests strong differences in degrees of erotic plasticity, changeability, in the males and females of many species, including ours. The human female's sexual behavior is typically far more malleable than the male's. Greater erotic plasticity leads most women to experience more variation in their sexuality than men typically do, and women's sexual behavior is far more responsive to social pressure. This greater plasticity could manifest through changes in whom a woman wants, in how much she wants him, her, them, and in how she expresses her desire. Young males pass through a brief period in which their sexuality is like hot wax waiting to be imprinted, but the wax soon cools and solidifies, leaving the imprint for life. For females, the wax appears to stay soft and malleable throughout their lives. This greater erotic plasticity appears to manifest in women's more holistic responses to sexual imagery and thoughts. In 2006, psychologist Meredith Chivers set up an experiment where she showed a variety of sexual videos to men and women, both straight and gay. The videos included a wide range of possible erotic configurations: man-woman, man-man, woman-woman, lone man masturbating, lone woman masturbating, a muscular guy walking naked on a beach, and a fit woman working out in the nude. To top it all off, she also included a short film clip of bonobos mating. While her subjects were being buffeted by this onslaught of varied eroticism, they had a keypad where they could indicate how turned on they felt. In addition, their genitals were wired up to plethysmographs. Isn't that illegal? No, a plethysmograph isn't a torture device, or a dinosaur for that matter. It measures blood flow to the genitals, a surefire indicator that the body is getting ready for love. Think of it as an erotic lie detector. What did Chivers find? Gay or straight, the men were predictable. The things that turned them on were what you'd expect. The straight guys responded to anything involving naked women, but were left cold when only men were on display. The gay guys were similarly consistent, though at 180 degrees. And both straight and gay men indicated with the keypad what their genital blood flow was saying. As it turns out, men can think with both heads at once, as long as both are thinking the same thing. The female subjects, on the other hand, were the very picture of inscrutability. Regardless of sexual orientation, most of them had the plethysmograph's needle twitching over just about everything they saw. Whether they were watching men with men, women with women, the guy on the beach, the woman in the gym, or bonobos in the zoo, their genital blood was pumping. But unlike the men, many of the women reported via the keypad that they weren't turned on. As Daniel Bergner reported on the study in the New York Times, with the women, mind and genitals seemed scarcely to belong to the same person. Watching both the lesbians and the gay male couple, the straight women's vaginal blood flow indicated more arousal than they confessed on the keypad. Watching good old-fashioned vanilla heterosexual couplings, everything flipped, and they claimed more arousal than their bodies indicated. Straight or gay, the women reported almost no response to the hot bonobo-on-bonobo action, though again, their bodily reactions suggested they kinda liked it. This disconnect between what these women experienced on a physical level and what they consciously registered is precisely what the theory of differential erotic plasticity predicts. It could well be that the price of women's greater erotic flexibility is more difficulty in knowing and, depending on what cultural restrictions may be involved, in accepting what they're feeling. This is worth keeping in mind when considering why so many women report lack of interest in sex or difficulties in reaching orgasm. This disconnect is also relevant to the research on jealousy we discussed in Chapter 10. If you aren't confused already, consider that research psychiatrist Andrei Anokhin and his colleagues found that erotic images elicit significantly quicker and stronger response in women's brains than either pleasant or frightening images without erotic content. They showed 264 women a randomly ordered collection of images ranging from snarling dogs to water skiers to semi-naked couples getting hot and heavy. The women's brains responded about 20% faster to the erotic images than to any others. With men, this eager responsiveness was expected, but the results among the supposedly less visual, less libidinous women surprised the researchers. The female erotic brain is full of such surprises. Dutch researchers used positron emission tomography, PET, to scan the brains of 13 women and 11 men in the throes of orgasm. While the brevity of the male orgasm made reliable readings difficult to get, the heightened activity they found in the secondary somatosensory cortex associated with genital sensation was what they'd expected. But the women's brains left the researchers befuddled. It seems the female brain goes into standby mode at orgasm. What little increase in cerebral activity the ladies' brains exhibited was in the primary somatosensory cortex, which registers the presence of sensation, but not much excitement about it. In women, the primary feeling is there, one of the researchers said, but not the marker that this is seen as a big deal. For males, the touch itself is all important. For females, it is not so important. Every woman knows her menstrual cycle can have profound effects on her eroticism. Spanish researchers confirmed that women experience greater feelings of attractiveness and desire around ovulation, while others have reported that women find classically masculine faces more attractive around ovulation, opting for less chiseled-looking guys when not fertile. Since the birth control pill affects the menstrual cycle, it's not surprising that it may affect a woman's patterns of attraction as well. Scottish researcher Tony Little found women's assessment of men as potential husband material shifted if they were on the pill. Little thinks the social consequences of his finding may be immense. Where a woman chooses her partner while she is on the pill and then comes off it to have a child, her hormone-driven preferences have changed and she may find she is married to the wrong kind of man. Little's concern is not misplaced. In 1995, Swiss biological researcher Klaus Wedekind published the results of what is now known as the sweaty T-shirt experiment. He asked women to sniff T-shirts men had been wearing for a few days, with no perfumes, soaps, or showers. Wedekind found, and subsequent research has confirmed, that most of the women were attracted to the scent of men whose major histocompatibility complex, MHC, differed from her own. This preference makes genetic sense in that the MHC indicates the range of immunity to various pathogens. Children born of parents with different immunities are likely to benefit from a broader, more robust immune response themselves. The problem is that women taking birth control pills don't seem to show the same responsiveness to these male scent cues. women who were using birth control pills chose men's T-shirts randomly, or, even worse, showed a preference for men with similar immunity to their own. Consider the implications. Many couples meet when the woman is on the pill. They go out for a while, like each other a lot, and then decide to get together and have a family. She goes off the pill, gets pregnant, and has a baby. But her response to him changes. There's something about him she finds irritating, something she hadn't noticed before. Maybe she finds him sexually unattractive, and the distance between them grows. But her libido is fine. She gets flushed every time she gets close enough to smell her tennis coach. Her body, no longer silenced by the effects of the pill, may now be telling her that her husband, still the great guy she married, isn't a good genetic match for her, but it's too late. They blame it on the work pressure, the stress of parenthood, each other. Because this couple inadvertently short-circuited an important test of biological compatibility, their children may face significant health risks, ranging from reduced birth weight to impaired immune function. How many couples in this situation blame themselves for having failed somehow? How many families are fractured by this common, tragic, undetected sequence of events? Psychologist Richard Lippa teamed up with the BBC to survey over 200,000 people of all ages from all over the world concerning the strength of their sex drive and how it affects their desires. He found the same inversion of male and female sexuality. For men, both gay and straight, higher sex drive increases the specificity of their sexual desire. In other words, a straight guy with a higher sex drive tends to be more focused on women, while higher sex drive in a gay guy makes him more intent on men. But with women, at least nominally straight women, the opposite occurs. The higher her sex drive, the more likely she'll be attracted to men and women. Lesbians showed the same pattern as men. A higher sex drive means more women-only focus. Perhaps this explains why nearly twice as many women as men consider themselves bisexual, while only half as many consider themselves to be exclusively gay. Those who claim this just means men are more likely to be repressing some universal human bisexuality will have to consider sexologist Michael Bailey's fMRI scans of gay and straight men's brains while they viewed pornographic photos. They reacted as men tend to do, simply and directly. The gay guys liked the photos showing men with men, while the straight guys were into the photos featuring women. Bailey was looking for activation of the brain regions associated with inhibition to see whether his subjects were denying a bisexual tendency. No dice. Neither gay nor straight men showed unusual activation of these regions while viewing the photos. Other experiments using subliminal images have generated similar results. Gay men, straight men, and lesbians all responded as predicted by their stated sexual orientation, while nominally straight women, I contain multitudes, responded to just about everything. This is just how we're wired, not the result of repression or denial. Of course, signs of repression aren't hard to find in sex research. There's plenty. For example, one of the long-standing mysteries of human sexuality has been that heterosexual men tend to report having more sexual encounters and partners than heterosexual women do, a mathematical impossibility. Psychologists Terry Fisher and Michelle Alexander decided to take a closer look at people's claims regarding age of first sexual experience, number of partners, and frequency of sexual encounters. Fisher and Alexander set up three different testing conditions. One, the subjects were led to believe their answers might be seen by the researchers waiting just outside the room. Two, the subjects could answer the questions privately and anonymously. Three, the subjects had electrodes placed on their hand, arm, and neck, believing themselves, falsely, to be hooked up to a lie detector. Women who thought their answers might be seen reported an average of 2.6 sexual partners. All the subjects were college students younger than 25. Those who thought their answers were anonymous reported 3.4 partners, while those who thought their lies would be detected reported an average of 4.4 partners. So while women admitted to 70% more sexual partners when they thought they couldn't fib, the men's answers showed almost no variation. Sex researchers, physicians, and psychologists, and parents, need to remember that women's answers to such questions may depend on when, where, and how the question is asked, as well as who's asking. If it's true that women's sexuality is much more contextual than most men's, we might need to reconsider a lot of what we think we know about female sexuality. In addition to the distortions created by the age bias we discussed earlier, are 20-year-olds representative? How useful are the responses of women answering questions in a cold classroom or laboratory setting? How would our understanding of female sexuality be different if George Clooney distributed the questionnaires by candlelight and collected them after a glass of wine in the jacuzzi? Sexologist Lisa Diamond spent over a decade studying the ebb and flow of female desire. In her book, Sexual Fluidity, she reports that many women see themselves as attracted to specific people rather than to their gender. Women, in Diamond's view, respond so strongly to emotional intimacy that their innate gender orientation can be easily overwhelmed. Chivers agrees. Women physically don't seem to differentiate between genders in their sex responses, at least heterosexual women don't. Apparently, many women see the Mona Lisa looking back at them from the mirror. What are the practical effects of this crucial difference in erotic plasticity? To start with, we'd expect to find far more transitory, situational bisexual behavior among women than among men. Various studies of heterosexual couples engaging in group sex or swinging agree that it is common for women to have sex with other women in these situations, but that men almost never engage with men. Additionally, while we'd be the last to suggest popular culture is a reliable indicator of innate human sexuality, it's probably significant that women kissing women has quickly become accepted as mainstream behavior, while depictions of men kissing each other on television or films remains unusual and controversial. Most women presumably wake up the morning after their first same-sex erotic experience more interested in finding some coffee than in conducting a panicked reassessment of their sexual identity. The essence of sexuality for most women seems to include the freedom to change as life changes around them. There is, after all, a liberating simplicity in Mona Lisa's complexity, which Freud seems to have missed. The answer to his question couldn't be simpler, yet it contains multitudes. What does woman want? It depends. Chapter 21. The Pervert's Lament.
Paraphilias are not universally present in human societies. Their incidence could be greatly reduced if tolerance and education in sexual matters were more widespread. This is a most important but socially sensitive area of sex research. Alan Dixon.
While many women are freed by their erotic flexibility, men can find themselves trapped by the rigidity of their sexual response, like the male sheep and goats mentioned earlier. Once determined, male eroticism tends to retain its contours throughout life, like concrete that has set. Consequently, the theory of erotic plasticity predicts that paraphilias, abnormal sexual desires and behaviors, should be far more prevalent in men than in women, who would presumably be more responsive to social pressures and find it easier to abandon previous turn-ons or ignore unseemly urges. Nearly every source of evidence supports this prediction. Most researchers and therapists agree that these unusual sexual hungers are almost exclusively seen in males, appear to be related to early imprinting, and are difficult, if not impossible, to alter once boyhood impressions have hardened into adult yearnings. Purely psychological treatment for paraphilias and pedophilia have shown little success. The most effective treatments for the latter tend to be based upon biological approaches, hormone therapy, chemical castration. Once beyond the age of malleability, males seem to be stuck with whatever imprint they've received, latex or leather, S or M, goat or lamb. If the influences during this developmental window are distorting and destructive, a boy may grow into a man with an unalterable, nearly irresistible desire to reenact the same patterns with others. The ritualized, widespread pedophilia in the Catholic Church appears to be a prime example of this process, as does the Church's centuries-long attempt to cover up the issue. Recall Schopenhauer's famous quote, "Mensch kann tun, was will, kann aber nicht wollen, was will." One can choose what to do, but not what to want. Desire, particularly male desire, is notoriously unresponsive to religious dictate, legal retribution, family pressure, self-preservation, or common sense. It does respond to one thing, however. Testosterone. A man who suffered a hormonal disorder that left him with almost no testosterone for 4 months discussed his experience anonymously in a radio interview. Without testosterone, he said, "Everything I identified as being me was lost. My ambition, my interest in things, my sense of humor, the inflection of my voice. The introduction of testosterone returned everything." Asked whether there had been an upside to being testosterone-free, he said, "There were things that I find offensive about my own personality that were disconnected then, and it was nice to be without them. I approached people with a humility that I had never displayed before." But overall, he was glad to have it back because when you have no testosterone, you have no desire. Griffin Hansberry, who was born female but underwent a sex change after graduating from college, has another well-informed view of the powers of testosterone. "The world just changes," he said. "The most overwhelming feeling was the incredible increase in libido and change in the way I perceived women." Before the hormone treatments, Hansberry said, an attractive woman in the street would provoke an internal narrative. "She's attractive. I'd like to meet her." But after the injections, no more narrative. Any attractive quality in a woman, nice ankles or something, was enough to flood my mind with aggressive pornographic images just one after another. Everything I looked at, everything I touched, turned to sex. He concluded, "I felt like a monster a lot of the time. It made me understand men. It made me understand adolescent boys a lot." It doesn't take a sex change operation to understand that many adolescent boys have a frenzied focus on sex. If you've ever tried to teach a class containing more than a few, or tried to raise one, or recall the turbulent desires yourself, you know the phrase testosterone poisoning is not always used ironically. For most adolescent boys, life often seems, and is, violent, hectic, and wild. Countless studies confirm that testosterone and associated male sex hormones are at high tide from puberty to a man's mid-twenties. Here we have another massive conflict between what society dictates and biology demands. With every voice in a young man's body screaming for sex now, many societies insist he ignore these incessant urgings and channel that energy into other pursuits, ranging from sports to homework to military adventure. As with other attempts to block the unignorable importations of biology, this one has been a centuries-long disaster. Testosterone levels correlate to the likelihood of a young man or woman getting into trouble. In the United States, adolescent males are 5 times more likely to kill themselves than females are. A government study found that homosexual youth are 2 to 3 times more likely to attempt suicide than their heterosexual peers. Among Americans between 15 and 25, suicide is the 3rd leading cause of death, and teenage boys kill themselves at a rate double that of any other demographic group. Well-intentioned websites and presentations rarely, if ever, mention gut-wrenching, identity-clouding sexual frustration as a possible cause of some of this destructive adolescent behavior. Despite the omnipresence of billboards and bus stops featuring semi-naked, barely pubescent fashion models, significant parts of American society remain adamantly opposed to any suggestion that sexual activity may commence before the law allows. In 2003, 17-year-old honor student and homecoming king Gennaro Wilson was caught having consensual oral sex with his girlfriend, who had not yet turned 16. He was convicted of aggravated child molestation, sentenced to a minimum of 10 years in a Georgia prison, and forced to register as a sex offender for life. If Wilson and his girlfriend had just enjoyed good old-fashioned intercourse, as opposed to oral sex, their crime would have been a misdemeanor, punishable by a maximum of a year in prison and no sex offender status. The previous year, Todd Centers videotaped consensual sex with his girlfriend, who was over the age of consent. No problem, right? Wrong. According to Nebraska state law, although the sex itself was perfectly legal, taping it constituted manufacturing child pornography. The 17-year-old was legally permitted to have sex, but images of her doing so are illegal. Go figure. Adolescents all over the country are getting into serious trouble for sexting one another, snapping a risque photo of themselves with their cell phone and sending it to a friend. Turns out, in many states, these kids can be sent to prison, where sexual abuse is rampant, for photographing their own bodies, manufacturing child pornography, and sharing the photos, distributing child pornography. They're being forced to register as sex offenders, despite the fact that they themselves are the victims of their own crimes. Just say what? A 2005 survey of 12,000 adolescents found that those who had pledged to remain abstinent until marriage were more likely to have oral and anal sex than other teens, less likely to use condoms, and just as likely to contract sexually transmitted diseases as their unapologetically non-abstinent peers. The study's authors found that 88% of those who pledged abstinence admitted to failing to keep their pledge. If our distorted relationship with human sexuality is the source of much of this frustration, confusion, and ignorance, societies with less conflicted views should confirm the causal connection. Developmental neuropsychologist James Prescott found that bodily pleasure and violence seem to have an either-or relationship. The presence of one inhibits development of the other. In 1975, Prescott published a paper in which he argued that certain sensory experiences during the formative periods of development will create a neuropsychological predisposition for either violence-seeking or pleasure-seeking behaviors later in life. On the level of individual development, this finding seems obvious. Adults who abuse children were almost always victims of childhood abuse themselves, and every junkyard owner knows that if you want a mean dog, beat the puppy. Prescott applied this logic on a cross-cultural level. He performed a meta-analysis of previously gathered data on the amount of physical affection shown to infants, years of breastfeeding, percentage of time in direct physical contact with mother, being fondled and played with by other adults, and overall tolerance for adolescent sexual behavior. After comparing these data with levels of violence within and between societies, Prescott concluded that in all but one of the cultures for which these data were available, 48 of 49, deprivation of body pleasure throughout life, but particularly during the formative periods of infancy, childhood, and adolescence, is very closely related to the amount of warfare and interpersonal violence. Cultures that don't interfere in the physical bonding between mother and child, or prohibit the expression of adolescent sexuality, show far lower levels of violence, both between individuals and between societies. While American society twists itself into positions no yoga master could hold, Britney Spears was a vocal virgin while pole dancing in bikinis on TV, other societies ritualize and seek to structure adolescent sexuality in positive ways. Mongolian youth are encouraged to have sex with one another, with particular emphasis on the young men learning to control themselves and take pride in the pleasure they can provide a woman. The Murya of central India set up adolescent dormitories, called godals, where adolescents are free to sleep together, away from concerned parents. In the godal, the young people are encouraged to experiment with different partners, as it's considered unwise to become too attached to a single partner at this phase of life. If we accept that our species is and always has been optimized for a highly sexual life, and that adolescent boys are especially primed for action, why should we be surprised by the explosions of destructive frustration that result from the thwarting of this primal drive? Kellogg's Guide to Child Abuse. In 1879, Mark Twain gave a speech in which he observed, "Of all the forms of intercourse, masturbation has the least to recommend it. As an amusement," he said, "it is too fleeting. As an occupation, it is too wearing. As a public exhibition, there's no money in it." Funny guy, Mark Twain. But there was a seriousness in his humor, as well as courage. As Twain spoke, much of Western culture was waging a bizarre, centuries-long war against any hint of childhood sexuality, including masturbation. The merciless campaign against masturbation was just one aspect of the West's long struggle against the sinful yearnings within human sexuality. We've discussed the so-called witches burned alive for daring to assert or even suggest their eroticism, and doctors like Isaac Baker Brown, who justified barbaric, dangerous surgery as a cure for nascent nymphomania. These were not exceptional cases, as Twain knew. Following the advice of such prominent experts as John Harvey Kellogg, many parents of Twain's day subjected their children to brutal physical and mental abuse to stamp out any sign of sexuality. Otherwise, reasonable, if confused, people ardently believed that masturbation truly was the destroying element of civilized society, in the words of the New Orleans Medical and Surgical Journal. Though widely considered to be one of the leading sex educators of his day, Kellogg proudly claimed never to have had intercourse with his wife in over four decades of marriage. But he did require a handsome male orderly to give him an enema every morning, an indulgence his famously high-fiber breakfasts should have made unnecessary. As John Money explains in his study of pseudoscientific anti-sex crusaders, The Destroying Angel, Kellogg would probably be diagnosed as a klismaphile today. Klismaphilia is an anomaly of sexual and erotic functioning traceable to childhood in which an enema substitutes for regular sexual intercourse. For the klismaphile, writes Money, putting the penis in the vagina is experienced as hard work, dangerous, and possibly as repulsive. As a medical doctor, Kellogg claimed the moral authority to instruct parents on the proper sexual education of their children. If you're unfamiliar with the writings of Kellogg and others like him, their gloating disdain for basic human eroticism is chilling and unmistakable. In his best-selling Plain Facts for Old and Young, written on his sexless honeymoon in 1888, Kellogg offered parents guidance for dealing with their son's natural erotic self-exploration in a section entitled Treatment for Self-Abuse and Its Effects. "A remedy which is almost always successful in small boys," he wrote, "is circumcision." He stipulated that the operation should be performed by a surgeon without administering an anesthetic, as the brief pain attending the operation will have a salutary effect upon the mind, especially if it be connected with the idea of punishment. If circumcising a struggling, terrified boy without anesthesia wasn't quite what a parent had in mind, Kellogg recommended the application of one or more silver sutures in such a way as to prevent erection. The prepuce, or foreskin, is drawn forward over the glands, and the needle to which the wire is attached is passed through from one side to the other. After drawing the wire through, the ends are twisted together and cut off close. It is now impossible for an erection to occur. Parents were assured that sewing their son's penis into its foreskin acts as a most powerful means of overcoming the disposition to resort to the practice of masturbation. Circumcision remains prevalent in the United States, though varying greatly by region, ranging from about 40% of newborns circumcised in Western states to about twice that in the Northeast. This widespread procedure, rarely a medical necessity, has its roots in the anti-masturbation campaigns of Kellogg and his like-minded contemporaries. As Money explains, neonatal circumcision crept into American delivery rooms in the 1870s and 1880s, not for religious reasons, and not for reasons of health or hygiene, as is commonly supposed, but because of the claim that later in life it would prevent irritation that would cause the boy to become a masturbator. lest you think Kellogg was interested only in the sadistic torture of boys, in the same book, he soberly advises the application of carbolic acid to the clitorises of little girls to teach them not to touch themselves. Kellogg and his like-minded contemporaries demonstrate that sexual